Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today on our monthly book show, it's Books Within Books. With us is reference librarian Jill Erickson. Hi, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And author Peter Abrahams. Good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
And so, Jill, this was your brilliant idea.
I don't know what I was thinking. I was thinking broad, very broadly,
yes.
Very broadly. It was
challenging.
It's a challenging thing to put books together for this.
Me. I just want to say I'll never be the same.
It wasn't it hard? Between what I had in my house, right? Because I've got, not surprisingly, a lot of books in the house, and what I was finding on the shelves of the libraries. It's a tremendous amount. You can't believe how many books have been written about books.
Yeah. Oh, it's huge. It's
and then you have to narrow it down because you can't.
Well, yeah. Right. And yeah. you can do, I also realize, as you may have as well, is that you could do books about book jackets. I mean, there have been whole books written about how people design book jackets, which are really fascinating.
Yeah.
I didn't bring one, but they're really interesting. So you end up looking at just piles and piles of books, and somehow you cull down. And Peter, do you have a method for getting rid of things rather than?
Yes, scattershot 101. That's
how I do everything.
Does that work? Yeah. So it was right in my swing zone.
All right, Jill. Then kick us off. What's your first one?
All right. Well, I'm going to begin with what I think is a really lovely little bit from William Maxwell. And I have in my hands here Maxwell Later Novels and Stories, which is part of the series of the Library of America. And in this, they have right at the end, sort of toward the ends of this collection, they have an essay he wrote for the New York Times called Nearing 90. And this part about reading is so great, reading books. So I'm just going to read a little bit of this. Because I actively enjoy sleeping, dreams, the unexplainable dialogues that take place in my head as I'm drifting off, all that, I tell myself that lying down to an afternoon nap that goes on and on through eternity is not something to be concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
What spoils this pleasant fancy is the recollection that when people are dead, they don't read books. This I find unbearable. No Tolstoy, no Chekhov, no Elizabeth Bowen, no Keats, no Rilke. One might as well be, and there's a little line that says nothing. Before I am ready to call it quits, I would like to reread every book I have ever deeply enjoyed, beginning with Jane Austen and Isaac Babel and Sybil Bedford's The Sudden View, and going through shelf after shelf of the bookcases until I arrive at the autobiographies of William Butler Yeats. As it is, I read a great deal of the time. I am harder to please, though. I see flaws in masterpieces. So that's, I thought that was a good way to bring the show. And it's true. There are just piles, right, of books everywhere that you might want to read again. And yet you still want to keep reading new stuff. So it's and of course, you're writing new stuff all the time.
Well, that's a different ball of wax. Yeah, that's different. That's reading is easier than writing. I just want
to make that clear to everybody. Yeah.
What book was this again?
This is called Maxwell Later Novels and Stories, and the essay in it is called Nearing 90.
All right, Peter.
Well, first, let's start with 1001 Books for Every Mood. This is written by Hallie Efron, so full disclosure, she's a friend of mine, and it came out in 2008, so I suppose you could say it's slightly dated, but what she's done is she has all these categories of different moods for reading. For example, for a good laugh, for a good cry, to dream, to be astounded, to hit a home run. So let's, and then there are little symbols. It's a very little guide. So there's a little tiny fire, and that means provocative. So let's look.
I love that book.
So here in this mood is to get wasted. So if you're in the mood to get wasted, you turn to page 311, and there's a whole bunch of books, including, of course, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas by Hunter S. Thompson. So this is what Hallie writes. So it has a little provocative symbol and a couple others. Before he flamed out on drugs, journalist Thompson wrote this whacked-out autobiographical novel that appeared in Rolling Stone in 1971. It opens with protagonist Raoul Duke tearing down the highway to Vegas to cover a motorcycle race for a sports magazine with attorney Dr. Gonzo. The trunk of their huge rented red convertible looked like a mobile police narcotics lab with its galaxy of multicolored uppers, downers, screamers, laughers, plus booze. Hallucinations, paranoia, and car wrecks marked their trip. This book made Thompson and his style of gonzo journalism famous. And then there's often a little quote right from the book, and this is, and she calls that Department of Memorable Lines, and here from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is this: every now and then, when your life gets complicated and the weasels start closing in, the only real cure is to load up on heinous chemicals and then drive like a bastard from Hollywood to Las Vegas. 1001 books for every mood, Hallie Efron.
All right.
Well, and I have to say that I have handed that book to so many people. When I was working full-time at the library, I would be handing that up because people are desperate to find another good book, right? And that book actually helps a lot to find another great book.
Okay.
And I have a very similar book that I have brought along, which I love. It's called The Novel Cure, From Abandonment to Zestlessness, 751 Books to Cure What Ails You, by Ella Berthoud and Susan Elterkin. And I love the idea that you can be cured by books. I'm sure that it's true. This is part of their introduction. They write, "This is a medical handbook with a difference. First of all, it does not discriminate between emotional pain and physical pain. You're as likely to find a cure within these pages for a broken heart as a broken leg. It also includes common predicaments you might find yourself in, such as moving house, looking for Mr. or Mrs. Wright, or having a midlife crisis. Life's bigger challenges, such as losing a loved one or becoming a single parent, are in here too. Whether you've got the hiccups or a hangover, a fear of commitment, or a sense of humor failure, we consider it an ailment that deserves a remedy." And so they, in fact, have it organized in by topic, as it were. So, for example, you can find the book to read if you have for burning the dinner. If you have burned the dinner, they suggest The Belly of Paris by Emile Zola. Domestically speaking, there are few things more catastrophic than burning the dinner. Whether you have slaved for hours over a daube de bœuf or rustled up some crepe Suzette's, a scorched acrid offering fit only to be flung out onto the garden path for scavenging animals will leave you not just hungry, but ill-humored. On such occasions, grab The Belly of Paris, the third novel to be published in Zola's multi-generational Rougon Macquart saga. It tells the story of Florent Quenu, who returns to his native Paris to live with his family in an apartment on the edge of the newly rebuilt Les Halles food market. And she goes on to talk about the food market and how that's part of the book. But you can also have, there are a bunch of lists in here as well, if you don't have something specific. This, for example, is the 10 best novels for plane journeys. So gripping, you'll forget you're 35,000 feet up in the air. So you have, and included in here are a whole bunch of books, which most of which I have not heard of. But that is the other great thing about this particular book, is that you discover all these books that you
didn't even know existed.
That you did write. And then there's a section that's all 10 best list index. So if there's something particular you have in mind, it's here. And there's also the 10 best novels to cheer you up. So there's lots of possibility in here. Whether it's despair or happiness, you'll find the book for you in The Novel Cure by Ella Berthold and Susan Elterkin.
All right. Peter.
Well, I thought maybe I should do something about books on the book, right? Which, the Bible. And so I brought two, but I'll do the first one first. So they're both called A History of the Bible, which is very confusing. But one, this one, A History of the Bible by John Barton, is really about the texts of the Bible and where they came from. And he, both of these writers that I'm going to talk about, they're both very good at just skipping the whole question of divine inspiration. I mean, these books are written for readers who both believe in divine inspiration and those who don't. They're very good about that, and so I don't think they would offend anybody. This one, the first one, A History of the Bible by John Barton, is really about the texts and where they came from and kind of what they mean. And it's on, I would say, well, this is
reveals, what they mean.
Yes, what they mean. But this reveals more about me than I found it on a very high intellectual level. Meaning, this is not easy reading for me. But maybe there are people out there this would be a snap for. I don't know. But just to give you, he's a very fluid writer. It is kind of challenging. I mean, there's so much stuff I didn't know in here. I mean, there's a lot to think about. So let me just read this. He's writing now about rabbinic biblical interpretation. And he says, so this will give you an idea of the level it's on and how it makes you think. But though Judaism is a religion that is certainly a descendant of the Bible, it is by no means limited to its biblical heritage. And it uses the biblical text, often in a consciously playful way, to illustrate its practices and beliefs. In doing so, it tries to imply that these practices and beliefs are already present in the biblical text, but this is not a literal claim. The ingenuity in finding other passages that seem to help interpret the one at hand, often by what look like almost random word associations, is part of a great love of Scripture, even though to some non-Jews it seems uncontrolled and indeed arbitrary. It has come to enjoy a new lease of life in recent literary readings of the Bible, for which random association is no longer necessarily seen as a drawback, and more particularly in readings driven by psychoanalysis. As Alexander Samely points out, Midrash is a kind of postmodernism avant la lettre. Okay, so that... in there, you can kind of see where Jewish humor would come from and Hollywood, you know, and all this other. It's in kernels of this very serious stuff. So this is A History of the Bible by John Barton and, you know, more than you need to know, but a fascinating book.
And this, what about the second one?
Want me to do the second one now?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, totally different. because now what we're... okay, so the second one is also called A History of the Bible by Christopher de Amel. And this is the Bible as a physical book. The development of it from the first, right, the Dead Sea Scrolls. He's terrific on the Dead Sea Scrolls and all that, which isn't actually the Bible, but all that kind of thing, to the great illuminated manuscripts of the Middle Ages, and then Gutenberg and that, revolution. So, and the King James Version. So all that, where he's not so much talking about the text and what they mean, but just the Bible as an object. And this is, the illustrations in this book are fantastic. I mean, just for that alone. But I'll give you, this is how he got in. He too is a very fluid writer and very interesting. And this is how he first developed his interest. He's from New Zealand. I myself began looking at antiquarian books in about 1964 in Dunedin, New Zealand, when I was 13. My guide was old Mr. A.H. Reed, afterwards Sir Alfred Reed, who had specifically collected Bibles from a Christian standpoint and who had presented his collection to the Dunedin Public Library. I was entranced by these venerable books. Mr. Reed encouraged me to open the glass cases and to look more closely at the books and to turn their pages. The collection includes no monuments of world-class importance, but it spans much of the period covered by this present book. There's a fragment of papyrus, the first I had ever seen. They're specimen leaves of a 9th century Evangelia and great Romanesque lectern Bibles. There are four 13th century Vulgates and a handsome Wycliffe Gospel book. There's a single leaf from a Gutenberg Bible, and there are wide-ranging Bibles of the Reformation and of the early missions, including those into New Zealand. The collection was assembled to illustrate the history of the Word of God, but to me it opened up the whole world of manuscripts, scribes and illuminators, printing and bookbinding and collecting, and the history of language, literature, craftsmanship and art, in short, of Western civilization. And when you, just by looking at the beautiful illustrations in this book of, so much love went into you know, the creation of them, you get the idea of the power of this book. So that's the second history of the Bible, this one about the book itself.
All right. We are talking about books on books this morning, and 866-999-4626 is our number. If you have a book you'd like to suggest for us, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It is our monthly book show. We're talking about books within books with reference librarian Jill Erickson and author Peter Abrahams. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill, what's next?
Okay, my next one is a novel, but it isn't exactly a novel. It's a hard book to describe, and I must have read a review of it, and it sounded sort of interesting to me. It's called Day's Work. And they put it right on the cover, a novel, although it's more like a home diary than it is a novel, although it has novelistic things about it, by Chris Batchelder and Jennifer Habel. And the two of them, he apparently had already written four novels. She is a poet. She has published poetry collections. And during COVID, they started writing this book. And it is... to give you an idea, on the back, this is not a library copy I have in my hands, it's my own copy. On the back of the book, I've written like page after page of what I want to go back to. Like there are a bunch of, I'm a very big Mary Ruffel fan, there are a bunch of quotes in here about Mary Ruffel. Nauchon Island is in here that there's a mention of. Updike is mentioned. Thoreau is mentioned. The Houghton Library, the Berkshire Athenaeum. I mean, it's because she's working on this book supposedly about Melville. And as one of the reviews said, a remarkable, unusually rewarding work. I agree with that. An obsession with Herman Melville emerges amid pandemic lockdown, which is exactly what does, in fact, happen in the course of the book. They also write, she collects and connects facts about Melville and references from his biographers and other writers, E.M. Forster, Walker Percy, William Gaddis, Marilyn Robinson, Lauren Groff et al., in a way that points up the delights of literary trawling. Elizabeth Hardwick's short life of Melville and his marriage are tied to Hardwick's rocky union with Robert Lowell, as well as Melville's intense friendship with Hawthorne. The toll, you learn a lot about Melville's intention with Hawthorne during this book. The toll that our husband and wife, a remarkable, unusually rewarding work. And it is, as I say, very hard to explain this. It is all sort of two sentences at a time separated with a lot of space in between. Here's one little bit. It so happens, and it's her obsession with Melville that really comes across for all of you, Melville. Even if you don't like Melville, it really comes across as an interesting guy. It so happens that a lock of hair is among the items collected in the Herman Melville papers housed at Harvard's Houghton Library, labeled, quote, a lock of Toby's hair, end quote, and dated 1846. The hair belonged to Richard Tobias Green, Melville's shipmate on the whaler Acushnet, and his companion during many of the adventures recounted in Melville's first book, Teepee. After a year and a half at sea and increasingly disgruntled with conditions on the Acushnet, Melville decided to abandon ship in the Marquesas Islands. He was, according to Jeffrey O'Brien, an instinctive escape artist. She writes a lot in here about Melville and Melville's relationships with various people. And she also talks about Melville's biographers, which has really another very interesting twist in this book, which is, again, they call it a novel. Yeah, I'm not sure that's what it is, but it's great reading. Among all Melville biographers, only the biographer mentions the Nauchon Island guest register that Melville signed on July 13th, 1852. So you also have, you know, your Nauchon Island connection here. He was touring the Massachusetts coast with his father-in-law just before the calamitous reviews of Pierre began to appear. And here's one of the quote from the review. The amount of utter trash in the volume is almost infinite. And I have to say, this made me want to read Pierre. Have you ever read Pierre?
No, nor have I.
But this book really made me want to read it because they just trashed the book totally. And so it's just, but it's, again, it's sort of hard to describe what she's doing here because she, supposedly they wrote this together, the husband and wife, and I guess that they did, but it's just, I guess one of the things that I had been having trouble reading a full book, you know, reading a whole novel, and they call this a whole novel, and this is great, but it doesn't read like a whole novel because every line is, it's like two lines in every paragraph. Mm-hmm. And so you can go through these short, very short chapters with very short sentences and yet still get a lot out of the book. Mm-hmm. And she has some terrible things to say about Melville and how he treated his wife. So you learn a lot more about his family at large in this book than I knew. And I just really was engaged with that. And whether you will be, I can't guarantee. Yeah. Because I think it is, there was something about the moment that I read it that I was just really wanted to read. And here's one other little line. This is, and I see it was not Updike, but Paul Auster, who wrote that the summer before Hawthorne moved away from the Berkshires was, quote, the best moment of his life, whether he knew it or not. Mm. And a lot of this is about him wanting to move from the Berkshires. And
so definitely, if you're a Melville fan, that would be a book that you would probably enjoy.
I don't know, because it's pretty anti-Melville in a lot of ways. So you might not enjoy it, but
you'd learn a lot.
Well, from this, from what you just said,
yes.
I'm going to steal the idea of introducing more blank spaces in my work. Right.
Well, you know, it was, and every so often, you know, their kids are mentioned because, again, they're doing this from home during COVID. So, but I didn't find the kids as interesting as I did Melville himself and his wife and his family. And it's really a fascinating and yet quick read.
Okay.
And the Day's name again? Work.
Day's Work. Okay. Peter.
Well, this book is actually quite easy to describe. It's called The Diary of a Bookseller. It's by Sean Bythel, and he owns a bookshop that's called The Bookshop in Wigtown. And Wigtown is in Scotland on the Irish Sea. It's a diary. It's 1 year from February to February in 2014, every day in the shop. And so he'll start with online orders for book. Okay, so this is basically a secondhand bookshop. He does deal in new books sometimes, but it's basically a secondhand with thousands. It's a big old Edwardian, Georgian, like, townhouse in this town, very drafty. It's very Dickensian. It's the people come in off the street and just sit by the fireplace and don't buy anything, that kind of thing. But it's, so every day, it's each entry starts with the date, online orders, books found, and then the till total, what came in, like 66 pounds. How many customers? 7.
Wow.
And in between, he describes what went on. This book is so full. First of all, he's a kind of misanthrope, you know, a person who isn't really that fond of most humans. And he's often barefoot in the store. And the people who work for him are an odd cast of eccentrics. And the people coming into the store are an odd cast of eccentrics. And the books they're looking for are odd. And the whole thing is hilarious and mesmerizing. But I'll just...
Oh, it sounds like it could be a movie.
Oh, well, what a great idea.
Wouldn't it?
Okay, isn't there a movie already where Hugh Grant was a bookseller and famous Julia Roberts? Notting Hill, I think it was called.
Yes.
Where you could maybe develop, okay, this guy is not as good looking as Hugh Grant. Because there's a picture of him. He's not a
I don't know. Have you seen Hugh Grant as Oompa Loompa in the Wonka movie, the new Wonka?
No.
Oh, yeah, no, it's great.
Okay, so So here, let me just, to give you a flavor of this and what he's like, but you learn a lot about books here, by the way, too, and the value of them, and when he'll go to an estate, like someone will die, and the relatives will say, come over, we've got 20,000 books,
oh, wow.
And he'll go, and usually they want to get rid of all of them, right? There might be out of the 20,000, 20 are valuable, and he wants only those, but they'll only sell and condition. And then so he's got this huge amount of books.
Of them, yeah.
The other thing you learn is, I mean, this is, he's under enormous pressure at all times because Amazon has changed and is still changing the book business. So it's this giant that he has to both use because he uses some of their services and yet compete with somehow. That's a daily thing. And Amazon, you know, sends him little notices that he's doing badly on X, or he has to improve his performance on Y, or they will no longer do Z. It's really...
I was in a bookshop somewhere in Vermont not so long ago, and they actually had a sign up that said, "Do not buy this book from Amazon if you first look at it here and think you're going to buy it." And then people apparently do. They
all
go to the
time.
Bookshop. They look to see what's there, and then they buy it from Amazon.
Okay. See, I do just the opposite. I might look something up on Amazon, and then I go to the local bookstore and order it there.
Okay, that's wonderful.
Good. That's good work.
As a writer, if I can, now we're going completely off topic, for 1 second, because this is.
Let's do it.
And I don't want to offend Amazon too much
because still have a mortgage. Their naughty list.
Yeah. So, but you know, like, so for example, Mrs. Plansky's Revenge, this novel of mine, came out this summer, and I was on a national book tour. And first of all, I would not go to an author reading in a book independent bookstore. They're always in the independents without buying a book because the store is relying on this, right?
Of course.
And so I have seen this so many times where people come and, you know, I do my talk and everything like that, and I see them on their Kindle. And they're ordering the book.
Oh.
They came, but they're ordering the book from that. Oh. And I've actually signed Kindles.
You have?
Yes. Well, if someone comes and asks me, I'm not going to offend somebody wants to, you know. Anyway, to give you...
Go to your independent bookstore.
And we'll delete all... We'll edit that all out. Sorry, Amazon. It's gone. But here we have just a little something from Monday, the 24th of March, where he had 8 online orders and found 5 books. And so he writes as follows. This is Sean Beithel, the owner and the writer of this book. And this is maybe a little risque. Here we go anyway. In the emails today was one from a former employee, Sarah, who worked for me during school holidays a few years ago. And now he quotes the email. "Yo, bitch tits, I need a reference.
Whoa.
Here's the form attached. Make it good, you bastard, or I'll come and get you. Are we in trouble for that? Okay, I'm sorry. Forget this. So I wrote this. She emailed this, you know, vulgar,
nasty,
asking for a recommendation. And this is the recommendation he wrote, to whom it may concern. Reference for Sarah Pierce. Sarah works Saturdays at the bookshop, 17 North Main Street, Wigtown, for 3 years while she was at Douglas Ewart High School. When I say worked, I use the word in its loosest possible terms. She spent the entire day either standing outside the shop, smoking and snarling at people trying to enter the building, or watching repeats of Hollyoaks on 4OD. Although she was generally punctual, she often arrived either drunk or severely hungover. She was usually rude and aggressive. She rarely did as she was told, and never in the entire 3 years of her time here did anything constructive without having to be told to do so. She invariably left a trail of rubbish behind her, usually consisting of Earn Brew bottles, crisp packets, chocolate wrappers, and cigarette packets. She consistently stole lighters and matches from the business and was offensive and frequently violent towards me. She was a valued member of the staff, and I have no hesitation in recommending her." This gives you, I think, the flavor of this terrifically enjoyable book, The Diary of a Bookseller.
All right. Jill.
All right. I have a book called The Book by Mary Ruffel, who I just mentioned because she's mentioned in Day's Work. And this is a recent book which has their small pieces written about various things, and including, needless to say, the book. And here is her piece on the book, which is, That book sat on my various shelves for decades until I got around to it, and then it seemed to be written especially for me. I hope this provides some hope to the other unread books surrounding me who are wondering what will happen to them when I die. I don't have the heart to tell them they will all be sold or recycled and will never see one another again. I think we do books an injustice by cramming them so closely together on shelves. A certain intimacy inevitably occurs, and when they find themselves separated and stickered with a new price that underscores their loneliness, there is little that a new reader can do to ameliorate their sorrow but to read them and say, "Old friend, you were written especially for me." It's a collection of little essays, and as it was reviewed in Publishers Weekly, they described it as the generic title of this beguiling compendium of prose from poet Ruffel belies the richness and variety within. The fragmentary entries touch on an eclectic array of topics and range in length from a few lines to several pages, but they all demonstrate a poet's eye for brevity and language. The potent pieces resist easy interpretation, sparkling with the suggestiveness of Ruffel's poetry. Readers will marvel at the results. And it is a beautiful collection of, like, tiny essays, is one might call them. It is called The Book by Mary Ruffel.
All right. Peter, what have you got next?
Well, my next one has nothing that can't be talked about on air.
Good.
I hope this program is still on tomorrow. This one is called The Madman's Library, The Strangest Books, Manuscripts, and Other Literary Curiosities from History by Edward Brooke Hitching. And this one, too, has wonderful illustrations. So the contents of it, this is about books, for example, that aren't books, and all sorts of strange books in history. For example, here's a book that isn't a book. It's an embroidered linen jacket.
Oh.
And it's, you know, as you can see here in the studio, but no one else can,
It's written all over the jacket.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It's an embroidered. So the embroidered linen jacket of Agnes Richter, 1844 to 1918, a seamstress incarcerated in Heidelberg Psychiatric Hospital in 1893 until her death 26 years later. She embroidered biographical fragments in the cloth, such as, "I am not big. I wish to read. I plunge headlong into disaster," though much of the rest of the writing is indecipherable.
Wow.
So that there's that kind of thing. And then he does a whole chapter on strange titles of books over the years. So I will read a few of these titles. An essay on the art of ingeniously tormenting, with proper rules for the exercise of that pleasant art, 1753 by Jane Collier. And here's a probably a book related, although it came over 150 years later, How to Cook Husbands. By Elizabeth Strong Worthington. Here we have one, Pigs, How to Make Them Pay, written by C. Arthur Pearson. How to Avoid Huge Ships, by John Trimmer. A Handbook of Hanging, by Christopher Duff. Everything I Know About Women, I Learned from My Tractor, by Robert Walsh. So this book is just hilarious and full of really interesting things. And also the illustrations are great. And I recommend it highly.
Oh, and the title of the book again is?
Is The Madman's Library by Edward Brooke Hitching.
Interesting. All right. We're talking about books on books this morning. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to add to our list. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. It is our monthly book show. We're talking about books within books with reference librarian Jill Erickson and author Peter Abrahams. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill, what have you got?
Okay, I've got a novel that I have probably had sitting on a shelf somewhere for a long time and never gotten actually around to read it. It's called The Bookshop, a novel by Penelope Fitzgerald. And it is a very thin book, so you can read it actually pretty quickly if you're so inclined. If you don't have a lot of time, this is a good book. And here's a little bit from one of the reviews I read. Fitzgerald's early novel received quite patronizing reviews when it appeared. The Guardian suggested it was a slight book. And I love this part, quote, about really nasty people living in a really nice coastal town, end quote. Not that we're suggesting this has anything to do with the Cape. Such responses missed Fitzgerald's precise gift for dramatizing complex moral questions in the most quaintly innocuous of settings. The efforts of Florence Green, a middle-aged widow, to make a new life in an unpromising bookshop in a genteel Suffolk community becomes a memorable tragicomedy of stifling small-town English cruelties. It also marked the first full expression of Fitzgerald's perfectly poised satirical voice. And the character of Florence Green is really wonderful, and she's just trying to do something with her retirement years. I can relate to this. So she opens up this bookstore. But one of the things that happens is the as it says here, that morning, the Post had brought the inspection copy of Lolita. She took off the jacket and looked at the black cover stamped in silver. Dear Mr. Brundish, your letter to me when I first opened this shop was a great encouragement, and I am venturing now to ask for your advice. Your family, after all, has been living in Hardborough a great deal longer than anyone else's. I don't know if you have heard of the novel which Christine Gipping is bringing with this note, Lolita, by Vladimir Nabokov. Some critics say that it is pretentious, dull, florid, and repulsive. Others call it a masterpiece. Would you be good enough to read it and to let me know whether you think I should be doing right in ordering it and recommending it to my customers? Yours sincerely, Florence Green. And so she does, in fact, get a letter back from him. And he says, oh, you know, it's a great book. You should put it out. And she does. And she writes, he writes to her, you asked me a question. Yes, I did. It was about a new novel. You paid me the compliment of asking me a serious question, Mr. Brundish repeated heavily. You believed that I would be impartial. Doubtless you thought that I was quite alone in the world. That, as it happens, is not so. Otherwise, I should be an interesting test case to establish whether there is such a thing as an action which harms no one but oneself. Such problems interested me in younger days, but as I say, I am not alone. And he goes on to talk about his life, and he says, may I go back to my first question? She goes back when they're having this conversation. May I go back to my first question? I'm thinking of making a first order of 250 copies. This is, may I say, for a little seaside town. 250 copies of Lolita, a considerable risk. But of course, I'm not consulting you in a business sense. That would be quite wrong. All I should like to know before I put in the order is whether you think it is a good book and whether it is right for me to sell it in Hardborough. And as it happened, she does buy the books. They sells out, you know, almost immediately, but she becomes too, there's another woman in this novel who wants to take over the space that she's using for her bookshop. Mm-hmm. And her bookshop has been very, very successful. And I won't tell you what happened, but it's sort of a sad ending to the story. And there's ghosts in this.
Didn't you just tell us what happened by saying
yes,
it's a sad
I will.
Ending?
Yeah, it does have as I did. But, you know, I want to prepare you. I wasn't prepared. Sometimes you need to know if it's going to be a sad book rather than a happy book. And I sort of thought this was going to be a happier book than
it was
when I started reading it. And then gradually, because she at the beginning, of course, she's doing very well and things mm-hmm. change. But it is... It's beautifully written, and Penelope Fitzgerald went on to write lots of other books. This is one of her earliest, but this one is The Bookshop by Penelope Fitzgerald. She also wrote her novel Blue Flower, got a lot of attention when it came out, which was much after this one. But okay. It's a really interesting story, though, about I think one of the things I really liked about it was just how the town, this small town, interacted with one another.
Okay. All right.
Well, that's just circling back to the Diary of a Bookseller, the book was written in 2014. So I went online to look it up, and it turns out that it's prospering.
Oh.
So now, that he, and he himself had had a, there's the new picture of him, and he wasn't barefoot, and he had a haircut, and he looked
not like
Hugh Grant, but he looked better.
Well, okay. And this originally came out in 1978, which is, and the fact that she was using Lolita as this big plot turn was sort of interesting.
Okay. Right. What have you got, Peter?
Okay, this one is called The Book by Keith Houston, and this is, as he puts it, a cover-to-cover exploration of the most powerful object of our time. And this is maybe the only book I've ever had in my hands where you can, it starts teaching you stuff right off the top from the cover, because it shows what a book, all these bookmaker markings are on the cover, like head, foot, hinge, binding tape. And on the back as well, which is called the Verso, and there's a quote about the book, and then synopsis. I'll read a bit from the synopsis. We may love books, but do we know what lies behind them? In the book, Keith Houston reveals that the paper, ink, thread, glue, and board from which a book is made tell us as rich a story as the words on its pages of civilizations, empires, human ingenuity, and madness. Mm. So this book is all about physical books from papyrus right till, well, almost till now. But he writes this. Pluck a physical book off your bookshelf now. Find the biggest, grandest hardback you can. Hold it in your hands. Open it and hear the rustle of paper and the crackle of glue. Smell it. Flip through the pages and feel the breeze on your face. An e-book imprisoned behind the glass of a tablet or computer screen is an inert thing by comparison. This book is not about ebooks. This book is about the corporeal ones that came before them, the unrepentantly analog contraptions of paper, ink, cardboard, and glue that we have lived with and depended on for so long. It is about books that have mass and odor, that fall into your hands when you ease them out of a bookcase, and that make a thump when you put them down. It is about the quiet apex predator that won out over clay tablets, papyrus scrolls, and wax writing boards to carry our history down to us. So this book is full of love for books. And as you can tell probably by what I've said already, I'm really interested in medieval manuscripts. And so he's terrific on, you know, because these were written by these monks. And so, but I'd never thought about much about what the life of these monks was like. For a body of men who prize silence so highly, the monks responsible for the survival of Europe's written history were vocal in complaining about their lot. Banned from speaking aloud while at work, the margins of the pages on which they wrote became outlets for endless grousing about physical maladies and working conditions. Writing is excessive drudgery, wrote one broken scribe. It crooks your back, it dims your light, it twists your stomach and your sides. Thank God it will soon be dark. And it said another, eager for the gathering dusk to put an end to the day's work. But they were really driven to work because these were, you know, not the chief monks. These were the lowly ones. Okay, so supervisors hovered vigilantly at scribes' shoulders, and workers could leave only with permission of the abbot. Reluctant scribes of the Carthusians, a monastic order founded in France in the 11th century, were subjected to a very French punishment. A text dated to the 13th century describes how wine was withheld from any monk unwilling to submit to their scribal duties. So this is the book by Keith Houston, just terrific on the whole history of the physical book.
Yeah, something we take for granted, right? Yeah.
Yes, and I remember, like, I don't know, there was, you know, my handwriting was always terrible, and it's my fingers would hurt, and I didn't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
So we owe a lot to these guys before Gutenberg who made this all possible.
Yeah, okay. What have you got, Joe?
Well, I just have one more thing to say about The Bookshop, which by Penelope Fitzgerald, because it had a great first line in the review in The New York Times, which it did not get uniformly. And in this work in this particular review, Penelope Fitzgerald's novel, The Bookshop, is a little gem, a vintage narrative first published in 1978 of parochial English life in the late 1950s, a classic whose force as a piece of physical and moral map-making has not merely lasted, but has actually improved with the passage of years.
Oh,
so,
okay.
You know, I want, right, if so, I did yeah. not make it clear, okay. it's a good read.
It's a good read. Okay, got it.
And I also brought with me a picture book called Books Make Good Friends by Jane Mount. Jane Mount does great illustrations of books. And so this one is, in fact, about a little girl and what she really likes to do more than anything else to read. And one of the great things about this book is there are piles and piles of books in her room. And she, as she says at the beginning, "Hi, I'm Lottie. My mom says I'm shy. My dad says I'm a dreamer. And my little brother, Knox, says I read too much. I really love books. Books can transport you onto the back of a unicorn, to the burrow of a tiny mouse, or to a shipwreck at the bottom of the ocean. I read every chance I get." And it's all about her going to, when every the other kids are playing on the playground, she's there reading a book, but she finally finds a friend who also loves to read the way she says. Because she's sort of the kids aren't that nice to her on the playground, she says, "So I read a book instead. Books make good friends," which I would concur that books make good friends. And her family is always trying to get her to do something other than read books. And she says, "I get along with animals better than with people." And she's sitting there reading Charlotte's Web. So it's just it's a beautiful book about reading books and how important books can be to kids and how much they need books for various different reasons.
Yeah.
And so I highly recommend Books Make Good Friends by Jane Mount, and you will find so many books in here that you might be interested in reading.
Okay, Peter.
This is The Book of Lost Books by Stuart Kelly, an incomplete history of all the great books you'll never read. So this covers everything. It covers books that have been lost. In other words, they were written and now they're not around. It includes some incomplete books and also ones that were only imagined. For example, did you know that Dostoevsky had intended a second volume of The Brothers Karamazov? He wrote a few notes, but no book ever transpired. So there's a lot of speculation how he would have ended it. Or we have incomplete books. For example, Jane Austen's Sanditon, which I hope I'm saying that right because I haven't actually read it. But so it was incomplete, and it's a critique of hypochondriacs and cures. And it was begun when she herself was deathly ill. So she was satirizing these hypochondriacs, but at the same time, she wasn't one. She was actually belittling her own disease. It's kind of a real story of strength. Also, there are lost books like Nikola, and some of them are lost in dramatic fashion. For example, Nikolai Gogol burned the second half of Dead Souls after a religious conversion he had, where he thought that literature was pagan. So he burned it. And then we also have Stolen. William Burroughs wrote Naked Lunch, over 1,000 pages, but a lot of pages were stolen by Algerian street kids and lost forever.
Oh, wow.
And why would Algerian street kids
I don't know.
Just causing trouble.
Right. But one of the famous lost books was Aristotle's second book of Poetics, which was supposed to be about comedy. And that brings me to my only novel, which was The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco. And the MacGuffin of that book is this lost Poetics book by Aristotle about comedy, and Umberto Eco uses that to drive his whole story.
Oh, all right. So that is, and we will have a link with a list of all the books we talked about here today up on our website a little later this afternoon. We got to put this list together. So author Peter Abrahams, reference librarian Jill Erickson, as always, thank you. Thanks for our list of interesting reads this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.